Hi, I'm Shekhar Gupta and I bring to you a fresh episode of Cut the Clutter.
Since Punjab and the issues emanating from the escape, first of all the crackdown and then the escape of Amritpal Singh have been ruling our headlines and also have been haunting our minds, we decided this week that we'll take you back in these two episodes of Cut the Clutter. Frankly, you can call them Cut the Clutter or first person, second draft. You can choose that. They can fall into either category. We thought we'll take you back to the peak of trouble in Punjab in 1983-84 in the Bhindranwale era, with the hope and prayer that such a tragedy should never revisit Punjab or India. And you know, as we had said in the first of this two-part special Cut the Clutter, we had said that if you don't learn from history, you are condemned to repeat it. But particularly, if you tend to be complacent about what was a bad, unhappy, tragic phase in your history, you are sometimes condemned to relive it within the same generation. And that's what we don't want happening. So let's go back to where we left off yesterday. In the first part, we had left you with a situation that where we painted a picture of how the Golden Temple was like, how Bhindranwale's court was like, and many visits there and many conversations. So most of the conversations we quoted in the first part were from 1983, some from 1984 also. It was, however, by May of 1984 that it became evident that something catastrophic was going to happen at the Golden Temple. Intrigue hung heavy in the air as everybody, even Bhindranwale, felt insecure. I wrote a story headlined Temple Intrigue. Temple Intrigue in the 15th May issue of India Today, describing a string of cases of torture, assassination of suspected rivals and renegades, chopped bodies being taken out of the temple and dumped in gutters, a lone woman shot dead Surinder Singh Sodhi, who was Bhindranwale's favorite hitman, while he sat sipping tea outside a tea shop near the Golden Temple. And the woman, after shooting Surinder Singh Sodhi, screamed, waving her pistol, "Maine badla le liya hai. I have taken my revenge." Next morning, two assassins shot the tea shop owner. Several mutilated bodies then appeared in gunny bags here and there, and the local police had a rough time dealing with them, fishing them out of gutters. One of these evidently was that of Baljeet Kaur, the Dalit woman who had shot Surinder Singh Sodhi in revenge because she believed he had killed her husband. Policemen who put together that body said they had not seen such brutal torture before. I'm not describing that right now. It's not necessary. It was in this atmosphere of rising bloodletting, revenge killings and suspicion that Bhindranwale raised the pitch and Indira Gandhi decided to strike. On one of my recent visits to Amritsar, I spent some time with Mokam Singh, whose imposing figure is etched on my mind as one of Bhindranwale's closest lieutenants. Although he claims he never carried any arms, my memory tells me something else. He posed for pictures under a portrait of Bhindranwale, steel arrow and all, and argued passionately that his son was not a separatist. He only demanded autonomy for states, which is the norm now. Now he told me in Amritsar. His house, in fact, is not far from Amritsar's big mall. He was deliberately misunderstood, he said. That is why, because of their belief in decentralization, the ragtag group of Bhindranwale supporters that he leads had extended support to Aam Aadmi Party. This conversation took place in 2014 during parliament elections. But then, as the conversation went on, he relaxed. Santji, he said, was no ordinary human. Remember how his arms were so long they hung below his knees, just like Guru Gobind Singh. He was no ordinary human. Mokam Singh, 3 years younger than me actually, had transported me back to the Golden Temple in 1983-84 when people looked at Bhindranwale and quote-unquote pointed out the quote-unquote fact to you that his arms hung lower than his knees. But God's own truth, they did not. They did not if you believed your eyes. But in the Punjab of 1984, so many were not willing to believe what they could see with their own eyes, what they could hear with their own ears and comprehend. They simply believed what they wanted to believe. It was a phase of madness and so eminently worth forgetting. That conversation with Mokam Singh that I just quoted was from 2014. And while he said that he no longer had any commitment to any separatism, he also argued that Bhindranwale did not want any separatism. He just wanted a true federal structure in India. He posed for pictures. I took pictures of him with my camera, with my phone camera, then a BlackBerry, under the portrait of Bhindranwale carrying his stainless steel arrow. And as I was leaving his home, as I was walking out of his driveway, I saw his car. He had a new car, I think it was Hyundai, a new car, and I saw the number plate. The number on the number plate was 1984. You know why 1984 is so important. Now, 1984 is when Operation Blue Star took place. It's also the year when later Mrs. Gandhi got assassinated. It's also the year when those awful, horrible massacres of Sikhs took place. These were not riots. These were massacres, mostly in Delhi, but in many other parts of North India, but mostly in Delhi. And I covered those also as a reporter. As we go ahead, now that I'm doing some storytelling on that phase, maybe over the next couple of weeks, I will talk about that phase as well, what happened in Delhi, the assassination and the killings, etc. But before we get there, we have to tell you the story of Operation Blue Star, which came in the middle. The last conversation I told you had brought us to May, the summer, the peak summer of 1984, when it looked like it was inevitable that something catastrophic was going to happen at the Golden Temple. And then came Operation Blue Star in the first week of June 1984. Now, nobody can reconstruct the 72 hours of Operation Blue Star in 3,000 words that I had tried to do one of these installments of First Person Second Draft. You can't even detail them in 30,000 words. Books have been written about it, and by the finest reporters, notably the BBC's Mark Telly. Amritsar, Mrs. Gandhi's Last Battle, that was co-authored with Satish Jacob. Mark was the unofficial but undisputed dean of the Reporters' Corps, or Traveling Reporters' Corps, for two generations, and please do read this book for diligence and detail. Books have been written by the generals who led the assault. I'd pick my dear friend, Lieutenant General K.S. or Bulbul Brad, who lives in Bombay now. His book, Operation Blue Star, The True Story, published by UBS in 1993, for the army side of the story, told as honestly as possible for a partisan, albeit an exceptionally honorable soldier. He, by the way, survived an assassination attempt by knife-wielding radical Sikhs in London while he was on a visit there, in fact, in the Mayfair area of London. In fact, just after the attack, while he still had the bandages on his face and neck, he featured in a Walk the Talk interview with me. I will share a link with you, both of the interview and also the text. There was also a series of TV documentaries put together and anchored by my old comrade and friend Kamar Sandhu, formerly executive editor of the Tribune, and later also an MLA for Aam Aadmi Party in Punjab. Check it out, that series of documentaries. Check it out for its brilliance, depth and honesty. Even I contributed my bit to the history of Operation Blue Star in some detail with a 27-page chapter titled Blood, Sweat and Tears in the Punjab Story, a book published by Rowley Books in 1984. There is no real mystery about the operation, how it started, how it ended. But there are other mysteries that endured for decades and some are still unresolved. Let me also talk about some of those. One, in fact, was resolved in 2013 in the memoir From Fatigues to Civvies, Memoirs of a Paratrooper, published by Manohar Publications, written by Lieutenant General V.K. Tubby Nair, whom I first met when he commanded the 8th Mountain Division at Zakhama in Nagaland. That was the counterinsurgency division in Nagaland then, and who later honored me by inviting me to speak at the release of his book at India International Center in Delhi. He was the Deputy Director General of Military Operations in 1984 at the headquarters and reveals in his memoir how the codename Blue Star was chosen. Contrary to speculation over the years, it had nothing to do with the way traditional or devout Sikhs dress or their color preferences. Tubby, as he was nicknamed, General V.K. Nair, Lieutenant General V.K. Nair, Tubby says he was driving home exhausted after a long day in the ops room, having planned the operation when a code name was yet to be found, and the signboard of a refrigeration shop caught his eye. It was selling Blue Star, a prominent fridge air conditioner brand in pre-reform India. Remember, this was 1984. Let's go with it, he decided. We still don't know where the names of the other two related operations came in from. Op Woodrose, that was the name given to the sweep sweep of the rest of the state to clear it of militants and to maintain order, and of an operation, a little operation, operation within operation called Op Metal, Operation Metal, to specifically catch or eliminate Jarnail Singh Bhendranwale and members of his inner core team. So we still don't know where those names came from. I wait for more memoirs. The greatest mystery of those 30 years, however, is how and why, with such elaborate planning, the army brass miscalculated on Blue Star so badly. It is tempting to say they were arrogant and underestimated the task, but that would be unfair. More than 70,000 troops had been called into Punjab, tanks, APCs and all. We usually said APCs those days, now we'd say IFV, Infantry Fighting Vehicle. Vijayanta tanks had been lined up along the final approaches to the Golden Temple much before the first shots were exchanged between the army and the militants. The media was cleared out even before the militants. All telephone lines were cut and the state put under not mere curfew but martial law of kinds of a sort for the first and hopefully the last time in our history. In the sense that a curfew pass could not be issued unless the army sort of countersigned it for all practical purposes. There was therefore no underestimation of the task on anybody's part, but I dare say now that there was a touching belief that the militants wouldn't fight. And if they did, their resolve would be broken in a couple of hours. All the bandobast, therefore, was to stun them with a display of firepower, a strategy of shock and awe, decades before it was given that name in Iraq by George W. Bush. All the generals involved, K.S. Bulbul Brar, Western Army Command Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Ranjit Singh Dayal, Army Commander, that is GOCNC, Krishnaswamy Sundarji, and his chief, General Arun Sridhar Vaidya, later assassinated by revenge-seeking militants while driving his Maruti 800 after retiring in Pune. All of them admitted to this miscalculation subsequently to some extent. There was a firm belief that Bhendranwale would not fight. He would surrender or try to escape. Just how serious this misreading was, I first learned from a senior intelligence bureau officer who spoke to me in some horror after spending the first few hours with the army commanders. He said he tried to tell them that Bhendranwale and his people would fight to the finish, but was not merely overruled but mocked. In fact, one of the generals pointed at some of his black dungareed commandos who were getting kitted out and briefed for the operations and said, "Have you seen these bhoots? Tu mere poot dekhe? Have you seen these bhoots, devils of mine? The terrorists have to merely see them and they will surrender with their tails between their legs." My IB friend, a wonderful professional and a patriot, retreated from the argument sort of fatalistically. He now lives in retirement close to Chandigarh. The first assault by the commandos ran into trouble. One set of audacious generals had overlooked the fact that they weren't against some armed rabble, but a small army of faithfuls led by someone exactly like them. In fact, a fellow general as bright, if not brighter, than all of them. Former Major General Shabik Singh had served with each one of those commanding the forces now in the Golden Temple, in Blue Star. He had received his fame organizing and training the Mukti Bahini during the Bangladesh War, and he was a master of guerrilla warfare. He earned infamy later, or sort of infamy later, as he was accused of irregularities and dismissed a day before his retirement. That was cussed. He was dismissed a day before his retirement, so he would be denied his retirement benefits, post-retirement benefits. But as most human beings do, he never believed he was guilty, but was victimized because of what else but his religion. And as time passed, he became more and more convinced that he was victimized because of his religion and he had done nothing wrong. He had found spiritual succor and now a new soldierly cause with Bhendranwale, although now in what he saw as the service of his faith, not his republic. Just how good was Shabik Singh? I won't go by hearsay, though even that makes him sound superhuman. Wading through the rubble at the Akal Takht a couple of days after the fighting, we found a copy of a book, a thin memoir written by a Pakistani brigadier who was taken POW in Bangladesh. It had been presented by an officer of the BSF's intelligence branch to Shabik Singh, who had quote-unquote sourced the book from across the border. It had a warm and respectful note to Shabik Singh from his BSF fan, saying how happy he was to see high praise for the now rebel general from the Pakistani brigadier, and what a privilege it was to present the book to him. The Pakistani brigadier had said how remarkably good Shabek Singh had been in training the Mukti Bahini. Since the book was being thrown in the rubble, I picked it up and kept it. In any case, the defense of the Golden Temple was not so much about high strategy or even guerrilla warfare. It was more like a battalion-level tactical defense of a built-up complex of buildings. They provided alleys, parapets, machine gun emplacements, tunnels, towers, and lots of ancient marble walls, more impregnable than modern armor. Most importantly, it had a string of manholes. So important because it was inside them that Shabek Singh had placed his LMGs, which sprayed grazing fire at assault troops, while automatics positioned higher up rained sweeping fire on them. Together, they fully covered the small open courtyard, maybe half the size of a football field, where the attackers had to expose themselves to reach the Akal Takht. This was his designated killing ground. Anybody with the basic knowledge of infantry warfare would tell you that, or would understand what we are talking about. This was his designated killing ground, as it would be defined in classic infantry defense manuals, specifically, in this case, following the principles of what acronym-loving armies called FIBUA, which is fighting in built-up areas. Manhole LMGs were so effective because they denied the attackers the basic defensive tactics of hitting the ground and crawling, because the bullets then got you in the bodies or heads instead of merely the legs. A very large number of the Jawans, therefore, were injured in the legs, including young 6th Second Lieutenant Jasbir Raina, who volunteered to lead the first platoon of 10 guards. He was awarded Ashok Chakra, the highest peacetime gallantry award, and came to accept it from the president on a wheelchair. If you look at the pictures of rows of beds from a military hospital treating the injured after Blue Star, you'd be stunned, as I was, to see how many of them had injuries, bullet injuries in their legs. Shabek wasn't foolhardy to think he would win. His tactics was to optimize his resources, snipers behind any hiding place, every room along the parikrama, circumambulation of the temple infested by a gunman or two, so any probing patrols would be cut down, others sprinting up and down the staircases linking just the two floors of the building and their parapets. His idea was to inflict as many casualties as possible and thereby delay the inevitable so that Bhindranwale supporters in the villages had enough time to organize mobs to converge on Amritsar and make further army operations impossible, unless Indira Gandhi was willing to inflict scores of Jallianwala Baghs in Punjab. It was a sound approach that succeeded tactically. The commandos did not get very far, took several casualties, and also underlined the general's unthinking impatience in launching them in black dungarees on white marble as it gleamed in bright moonlight. A more conventional infantry charge by the troops of 10 guards was stopped as well as it spilled in from the main entrance. This was the first time the generals were made to wonder if they had miscalculated. More assault troops launched from other directions were similarly pinned down. Typical of the Indian doctrine in such situations, the army carried out incremental escalation and not with the best results. One infantry unit after another was thrown in, but casualties only mounted. Then an approach was tried through an APC, armored personnel carrier, but again sort of half-heartedly in a wheeled old Scott, not infant fighting vehicle. In a wheeled old Scott, see the picture on your screens, rather than a tracked Russian BMP with better armor and firepower. That Scott was knocked out by a militant RPG-7 rocket launcher, over. There was much recrimination on this later as to why such a half-hearted thing was done. Did intelligence warn the army of the presence of such a weapon, that RPG was available with militants, or were the generals being too arrogant or maybe incompetent in not anticipating this? That night, as I sat on a high terrace that did not have a view of the battleground but help you understand the story with flashes, fires and explosions, I recorded the night's noises on a tiny tape recorder, as also some of the police and army wireless conversations on a radio with FM band. FM radio, by the way, had not arrived in India yet. But if you had radio then with FM band, you could sometimes pick up police and occasionally even army communication. Security forces then, in fact, were using some of the same frequencies on which we now listen to music. These conversations got more frantic as the night ended. There were nearly 3,000 infantry troops pinned down. in the temple on white marble, hundreds of wounded, more than 100 bodies. This time of the year, early June, the sun comes out really early, and every soldier still alive, all the thousands of them, would be target practice for snipers as the sun came out. And that's what worried the generals. As often happens in such situations, the battlefield, the terrain, was the best force multiplier for the defender. The defender could hide and fire, whereas the attackers had to expose themselves. This level of casualties was unacceptable, so further escalation became inevitable, so the general said subsequently. For greater detail, I would again shamelessly refer you to my Blood, Sweat and Tears chapter in the Punjab story. I will share a facsimile of the book's jacket. I believe that the book has been republished and you can find a copy in the markets. But even later, I can see nothing less regrettably than a story of incredible military courage, and yet I say with humility, incompetence, courage and incompetence. No soldier flinched even when faced with an impossible task, and the generals who had misread and miscalculated played on incrementally until the dawn threatened and artillery, not heavy, but artillery nevertheless, was called out along with Vijayanta tanks that blazed with their main guns. And the brutal destruction of the Akal Takht building was now launched. If Bhindranwale wouldn't flee or surrender or come out in a suicidal charge, he would be entombed there now. Now, what were the generals thinking? The thought was, if Bhindranwale wouldn't flee or surrender or come out in a suicidal charge, he would be entombed in the Akal Takht now. They were Vijayantas to the left of the Holi Sarovar, firing from just a couple of hundred yards, and howitzers on top of facing buildings firing in direct mode. This was the equivalent of a sledgehammer where a psychological or at worst surgical strike had been anticipated. There was never any doubt who would win, but the cost in lives, sentiment, political consequences, hurt among a population through generations, and a legacy of anger and bitterness had not been imagined. But the army generals were not the only ones who had miscalculated. Bhindranwale too had made similar, arrogantly delusional blunders. He had boasted that the six in the army wouldn't fight him. Two of the three generals involved, Brar and Dayal, were six. Brar told me in his walk-the-talk conversation with me shortly after the attack on him in London that I mentioned a little bit earlier, that he addressed his troops just before the assault. And he said, everybody, particularly six, if they had any hesitation, had the option to opt out. Nobody did. Lieutenant Jasbir Singh Raina, in fact, volunteered to go in first. He's the one we mentioned a little bit earlier who got the Ashok Chakra. If the generals showed an underestimation of the militants' fervor and tactical dash, Bhindranwale and sadly Shabek Singh too showed similar lack of appreciation of the ethos of their own country's army. Many militants and civilians died, but the army suffered gravely too, and brutally so. Responding to my earlier writings on this subject, I once received a touching email from K. Ramkumar, then the HR head of ICICI Bank, mentioning that his cousin was part of the Thambis of the hapless Madras Regiment, I think it was the 26th Battalion of Madras Regiment, that suffered severely in the assaults. 26th Madras it was, and I had the privilege of being taken under their wing, even while the wounded were being tended to. They suffered heavy casualties, and when one of the assault sections managed to enter the Akal Takht, the 26th Madras assault sections, the JCO leading it was overpowered, blinded, and flung from the top of the building to the marble courtyard. But the cruelest, saddest, and most unnecessary loss of life was that of battalion doctor Captain Rampal, more than 24 hours after the fighting was over. He was walking around looking for the wounded from any side to tend to when a group of snipers hiding in one of the basements dragged him in, demanded that none else than the head priest of the temple be sent down to negotiate with them, and when that wasn't done, the doctor was tortured to death, his body dismembered. The officers of the battalion, 26 Madras, led by Lieutenant Colonel Panikkar, took me to their mess one evening and fed me a meal of sambar and curd rice from their langar, which was such a blessing after a week of dry rations, and told more stories. One of these stories was of Lieutenant Ram Prakash Roperia of Jind in Haryana, the baby of the battalion, just a lieutenant. His English was rather basic, but like any self-respecting Haryanvi, he would speak in no other language. So everybody called him by a mockingly anglicized name, Robert Prince Roperia. Lieutenant Robert Prince R.P. Roperia fell to a sniper bullet on the afternoon of 6th June as he climbed down a rope ladder from the wide Parikrama parapet where several of his comrades lay flat to escape snipers. In the 46 degrees sun, exposed to full sunlight, for all of the day they were dying of thirst and heat stroke, and young Robert Prince, a baby officer, volunteered to go down to bring water. A sniper in the temple shot him in the neck. Roperia died 3 days later. It was while talking about his sacrifice at the Sambar Langar at 26 Madras Tactical Headquarters, as it was, that night, in June of 1984, that I got my finest lesson ever in leadership. And it's a line I have often used since in my speech, in my writing. What is the line? There is a moral dimension to leadership. If there were so many soldiers lying flat on the parapet, many of them were experienced soldiers, why did the youngest, and that too an officer, have to expose himself to bring water? Why couldn't he just tell one of the jawans to do it? Because, said Colonel Panikkar, and I quote him, there is a moral dimension to leadership. If the officer is not in front, why would the troops follow him to whatever consequences? Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Panikkar. Wherever you are, you gave me a lesson no life coach or famous general ever could. There were so many other mysteries and mythologies. What happened on the first night of fighting, for example, in the Sarais, from where several Akali leaders were rescued and many militants escaped, while a sudden flurry of grenades and the confusion that followed led to the death of a very large number of people, maybe a couple of hundreds in crossfire, many of them innocent pilgrims. It was later said that the army unit there from 9th Kumau Regiment, 9th Battalion of Kumau Regiment, had lined up the 6th and shot them randomly. That was the allegation. Frankly, I tried every source possible, but could never confirm this. But that there were many deaths, most of them unnecessary, undeniable. Many Sikh survivors, including priests, backed the deliberate massacre story. But my sources in the army always insist that this was just murderous confusion. It was a melee where lots of people had automatic weapons. And it was a melee, they claim, that was caused by militants, some of whom hid in the pilgrims' room in the Sarai and cut down the soldiers who tried to clear them. The Kumaunis responded by presuming every room to be terrorist occupied and fired, also resulting in a lot of innocent deaths. I'm still not willing to buy the deliberate massacre story, though many survivors have repeated it. In so many decades of covering the army's operations, I've found Indian soldiers to be mostly honorable, and the officers, if anything, caring and cautious to the extent of being soft in such situations. I wasn't in the Sarais that night, but everybody knows that the Kumaunis company commander, Major H.K. Palta, was. I cannot say who killed whom on that incredibly violent night, a tragic night, or why. But all the lives lost were Indian, and among the lives lost, all Indian was also Major Palta's. His family, I later found, lived in Noida. If anything, the fiasco at the Sarais that night concluded very sadly the story of those 72 incredibly tragic, bloody and violent hours. I will conclude this episode with a postscript. I have many nightmares from those three horrible days involving the bodies of fellow Indians, civilian, Sikh, Hindu, any faith, soldier, uniformed, not uniformed. One is of a truck parked at the Kotwali on the morning of 7 June when curfew had been relaxed for a couple of hours. An awful stench rose from the truck and what looked like blood mixed with viscous bodily fluid dripped from its leaky frame. I joined the several policemen who grabbed its rear wall and raised themselves to take a look at what lay inside the truck. There were scores, literally scores of bodies, and nobody could say who was a combatant and who was a devotee. But so many dead, fellow Indians rotting under the June sun. A DSP we all knew well lost his composure, Punjab Police DSP, and started screaming abuses, both at the army and Bhindranwale, for causing so much death. And he kept on saying, par ede naal terrorism to nahi ruk jana na, that this will not end terrorism. To the right of the truck, under the same sun, sat about 50 suspected militants with their limbs tied while soldiers kept watch over them behind an LMG on a tripod, and an officer, a Sikh, interrogated them in public. There was nothing physical about it, just an angry volley of basic questions. Possibly, it was sites like this that spread stories of Sikhs being lined up and shot by firing squads. The second was a string of three army trucks weaving its way through the narrow old city lane near what is called Brahmbhutta Akhada. Now that area has been gentrified, it's changed greatly. Area called Brahmbhutta Akhada, connecting the temple complex. Once again, I raised myself to the back of one of the trucks and found three rows of stretchers on either side with bodies of soldiers. The one on top, stretcher to the right, a boy from Garhwal Regiment, no more than 90 or 20 possibly, still had beads of perspiration on his nose. He must have just died. Both nightmares involve my dead countrymen, and these keep visiting me over and over again. Neither will go away anytime soon. Both nightmares involve my dead fellow countrymen. None of them will go away anytime soon. I hope you're finding these episodes and this method of history telling informative and useful. Encouraged by your responses, I might give you a couple more episodes of other aspects of what happened in that tumultuous year, 1984, in India's history, maybe in a week from now.